The Bad Christian, or Sermons on the Seven Deadly Sins and the Different Sins Against God and Our Neighbor Which Flow Therefrom, by Father Francis Hunold, translated from the original German edition of Cologne, 1740, by Father J. Allen, Emperor Martyr, Bishop James D. Ricard. On the manifold ways of defaming our neighbor's character, and on the excuses that are generally made for this sin, preached on the seventh Sunday after Pentecost. By their fruits you shall know them. St. Matthew 7:16. Introduction. Those false prophets who are dressed in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravening wolves, are like those detractors and calumniators who, with smiling countenances and every outward show of friendship, outrage Christian charity in their conversation and take away from their neighbor the best and most valuable thing he has, that is, his good name. I have already spoken of the malice of this sin and the difficulty of atoning for it. Ah, dear Christians, beware of those false prophets, those ravening wolves, and pay no attention to what they say. By their fruits you shall know them. You shall find out what they are by what they talk of, but you will be compelled almost to avoid society altogether if you wish to keep away from those who malign their neighbor. So common is this vice, and so little do people generally make of it. There you have the subject and the division of this instruction. Injuring the good name of others is a very common sin, and it is committed generally in many different ways. The first part. It is a sin that is thought little of, and that people try to excuse in different ways. The second part. These excuses are of no avail. Both parts will be in the form of a catechetical instruction. O Divine Master, teach us to understand the wickedness and danger of this vice, that we may always be on our guard against it. This we beg of Thee, through the intercession of Mary, Thy Mother, and of our holy angels' guardian. There are many forms of illness that the human body is subject to, which can cause it to die a natural death. But human ingenuity has also invented many ways of depriving people of life by violence, and it is still occupied in devising others. Into how many different forms are not steel and iron wrought for that purpose? Knives, halberds, swords, spears, axes, javelins, and darts are all deadly weapons with which one can cut and pierce both near and at a distance, so as to destroy life at once. The art of gunnery can hardly be carried to greater perfection, when an enormous weight can be hurled to a distance by cannons and mortars. What fearful havoc is caused by mines, bombs, and hand grenades! How many are shot down by pistols and muskets, as if death were too slow otherwise, and had to be urged on to seize his prey! Still, my dear brethren, I know not but that slanderous tongues are nowadays still more numerous ways and instruments of depriving others of their moral life, that is, of their honor and good name. St. Thomas reckons up 8 chief ways in which the fair name of others may be attacked, and it is a rare thing to find one who does not sin in one or other of them. The first is when one falsely relates something bad and disgraceful of another. This is the worst form of defamation of another's character, because besides the injury it inflicts on the fair fame of one's neighbor, it is also the malice of a grievous falsehood, which it is exceedingly difficult to make proper atonement for. The second is when one relates something bad of another that is true indeed, but is not yet publicly known. That is a sin that violates flagrantly the right that everyone has to his good name as long as his faults are secret. The third is a common trick of slanderous tongues, and it consists in making a great crime out of a small fault and in always causing it to appear far worse than it is in reality. For instance, a man happens to be guilty of some slight breach of trust or to be caught in the act of committing a trifling theft. He is at once put down as a thief. He who has once been guilty of a sin of impurity is spoken of as being completely addicted to that vice. He who happens unintentionally to take a trifle too much drink is at once set down as a drunkard. In the same way, too, if a man lets fall a word inadvertently against his neighbor, he is considered a slanderer. All that is very wrong. There is a great difference between committing a sin once and being in the habit of committing it. As the saying goes, one swallow does not make a summer. He who has told one lie does not deserve to be called a liar. He who has once given way to anger must not therefore be called a passionate man. Servants are especially apt to sin in this way by talking of what goes on in the house and attributing to a whole family a fault of which one member alone is guilty. For instance, the master alone has the habit of cursing and swearing, but the servants make it appear that the whole family is addicted to the same habit. It is fearful, they say, to be in that house. There is nothing but profane language heard in it from morning till night. There can be neither luck nor grace in a house like that, etc. Thus the whole family is suspected of being given to using bad language. The mother alone may be rather too indulgent to her children or to one of them. Oh, the servants say, there is no Christian training in that house. The children can do as they please. Nobody pays the least attention to them. Thus, the whole family is made to suffer unjustly. The wife alone may be of a sour, quarrelsome disposition, so that she is very severe with the servants when they do anything wrong. Oh, the latter say, there is neither peace nor rest in that house. I cannot stand it for another year. Evil-tongued people that you are, why must strangers know what goes on in the house? And if you are bent on defaming your neighbor's character, at least let the innocent go free, for they are not to blame for the faults you speak of. A fourth and still more wicked manner of injuring the character of others consists in attributing wrong motives and intentions to them. As I have elsewhere explained, these motives and intentions are supposed to be gathered in with sufficient certainty from a person's least movement, from his words, his actions, his behavior, and even his dress, so that they can be made the subject of conversation. See, these evil-tongued people say, how often that young man, that young woman, that neighbor, that priest goes to that house. He or she cannot mean any good by it. We can easily imagine what goes on there. That person is very generous in giving alms to the poor, but we know why. He does not always do it for God and his soul's sake. That wife, that daughter, always appears at church in grand style. It is something else besides devotion that brings her there. I lately heard those two young people talking together, and I knew by their laughter what was going on. Did you not notice how so-and-so behaved when that person came into the room? I can easily guess what he was thinking of. One can know by merely looking at that man that he is not good. And in the same way, even works of piety are falsely interpreted and are made to appear vices. Now is it not real diabolical malice thus to judge from uncertain outward signs of a man's inward disposition, which is known only to himself and to God, and to make them the subject of talk? Still, it is, unfortunately, only too common. A vice among scandal mongsters, who are constantly busying themselves with and criticizing the affairs of other people. The fifth manner of maligning one's neighbor is still more common, and it consists in not speaking directly from one's experience against the character of others, but in relating what one has heard to their disadvantage. Thus people say, I have heard so-and-so of that person on good authority, queer things are said of him, he is accused of having committed this or that crime. This is one of the most venomous kinds of defamation, because those who hear it believe that it is publicly known, and they will therefore have no hesitation in spreading it further, so that it is the same as if one were to make known his neighbor's disgrace in every country, by sending the news of it in letters to the public mails. Sixthly, I injure my neighbor's character by confirming a report that is prejudicial to him. Thus, a person remarks to me that he has heard something bad about so-and-so, but that he does not know whether to believe it or not. Oh, yes, I answer, I too have frequently heard the same thing. In that way, I confirm the report and strengthen the bad opinion that he whom I am talking to has of my neighbor. Or, by contradicting and endeavoring to disparage what is said in praise of another, as people often do through hatred, envy, or pride, thus something praiseworthy is related of one who is absent. Oh, I say, with evident marks of displeasure, you do not know the man as well as I do, otherwise you would not talk in that way of him, and you would soon change your opinion. Or else, I am surprised, indeed, to hear that of him. I did not think he was capable of behaving so well. Now I see that, as the fable says, a tortoise may catch a hare. Or else I say, it is not true. People praise that man without reason, and the half of it is gross flattery. Or else, so say those who are dependent on him and who wish well to him, but I know better what sort of a man he is. Seventhly, I can injure my neighbor's honor, and that grievously, by keeping silence. Thus, when he is praised, I say nothing, although, as all those who are present know, I am well acquainted with him. Or else I assent to what is said in such a way as to show that I believe quite the contrary. Or I answer somewhat in this style, I dare not say all I know. I do not wish to speak ill of anyone. I want to leave every man to himself. God forbid that I should malign my neighbor. In this way, a deeper wound is sometimes inflicted on another's good name than if the fault of which he is guilty were told out plainly, because those who are present imagine him to be guilty of some far more grievous offense, which I do not wish to speak of. Eighthly, I can injure my neighbor's fair name by outward signs. For instance, certain vices are spoken of without any one being directly accused of them. I press my neighbor's foot, or his arm, or make some other sign, to show that I know him to be guilty. Even during a sermon, when a certain case is explained, if I look or smile at a certain person with such an expression as to make it evident that I am referring to him what the preacher is saying, it is the same as if I said out openly, that suits you, there is something for you. I sin in the same way by remarking after the sermon that so-and-so got his share today. It is a pity that certain persons were not present, as they might have heard something that would do them good. Further, one can defame his neighbor even when giving good advice. Thus, parents sometimes say to their children, see, my son, you must not be like that other boy. People say so-and-so of him, nor like our neighbor who has spent all he has on drink, nor like that other person who is suspected of theft and has lost all credit in consequence. Be careful, my daughter, to avoid the fate of that other girl who allowed herself to be so shamefully betrayed. Do not make yourself as common as that young woman who talks to everyone. In God's name, what have those examples to do with your warning? Can you not admonish your children to avoid vice and to practice virtue without at the same time revealing the faults of others and injuring their good name? Finally, the character of another may be injured even by praising or pitying him. Olas writes of some dealers in the black art who had the power of bewitching little children by praising and caressing them. "Oh," they would say to the mother, "what a beautiful child you have in your arms." And at once the child would commence to waste away till at last it disappeared like a shadow, and no one could tell what became of it. Slanderous tongues are skilled in a similar art. In order to give more force to the poison wherewith they intend destroying their neighbor's reputation, they first commence to praise him. Thus they say, "Such a one is a good, sensible, and honorable man, and he is esteemed by all who know him. I cannot understand how he could have committed himself so shamefully in that matter. What a pious, holy person that is! Who would think that he would have acted in that way? I am sorry for that man. If he had not that fault, he would be a splendid character," etc. Is not that ruining a man's honor by dint of praising him? "Nay," says St. Bernard, "this vice is so subtle that even pious people often inflict grievous injury on their neighbor's fair fame under the appearance of charity and a holy compassion." "You may see them," he says, "uttering slanderous words with troubled countenances. Alas," they sigh, "I am sorry to hear such things of the poor man. He is one of my best friends. I wish he had not gone wrong. If he had only followed my advice, how often have I not warned him to be more careful?" In that way, things are often made public that no one was aware of before by the person who thus gives expressions to his or her pity. And who would not believe what such people say? They must be persuaded of the truth of it, or they would not be so loud in their expressions of charitable compassion. These, according to St. Augustine, are the tongues from which David prayed to be freed when he said, "Deliver, O God, my soul from the sword, my only one from the hand of the dog." But why should David, who had killed with his own hand a fierce lion, fear the bite of a dog? Yet, my dear brethren, a raging lion is sometimes less to be dreaded than a crafty dog. And why? Because when you see the lion coming, you run away or try to defend yourself. But there are dogs that will come up to you in quite a friendly manner, without barking, and before you know what they are about, they have bitten you. In the same way, if I hear a man talking out boldly against his neighbor, I think at once that he is influenced by hatred, envy, anger, or malice, and I am inclined to put little or no faith in what he says. He is a raging lion. But he who first speaks in praise of his neighbor, and then, with sighs of apparent pity, relates something injurious to his honor, is like the cunning and treacherous dog. I cannot defend myself against the bad opinion he inspires me with about my neighbor. I have good reason for believing that what he says is true, and thus the honor of my neighbor has received a mortal wound in my estimation. Ah, my dear brethren, how many ways have been invented of injuring the character of others, and that alone should suffice to convince you that there must be a great number of people in the world who are addicted to this vice, some through wickedness, others through hatred and spite, and others again through sheer love of talk. With reason does St. Jerome say that there are very few who are altogether free from the vice of speaking injuriously of their neighbor. For it is such a subtle and treacherous vice that even they who have been so fortunate as to have conquered all other vices are at length caught in this last snare of the devil, defaming their neighbor and that too without fear or shame. Why is this? In my opinion, it is because people are accustomed to look on it as no great harm to speak ill of others, so that they try in every possible way to excuse it from sin, or rather, they do all they can to prevent themselves from being considered slanderers. But their excuses are of no avail, as we shall see in the second part. God forbid that I should slander my neighbor or bring disgrace on him. I have certainly told some things about him that are not to his credit, but I did not speak out of hatred, anger, or envy. I had not the least wish to injure his good name. What I said came in the ordinary course of conversation, and my only object was to pass away the time. This is generally the first and at the same time the lamest excuse of all. There is no doubt that most of the harm to the good name of others is done in that way. People must have something to talk about, and they bring under discussion a person who is absent and tear him to pieces, as if they could find no more interesting subject of conversation than that. If you cannot talk of anything else, you should hold your tongue and hear what the others have to say. You maintain that you had no bad intention, but what has that to do with it? In any case, you have injured your neighbor's reputation by your wicked talk. If I spoke of your faults and failings to others, would you be satisfied if I told you afterwards that I had no bad intention in doing so, and that I was only helping to keep up the conversation? If a thief steals your money in your absence and then tries to excuse himself by saying that he has not a bad intention in what he did, that he was only trying to pass away the time, and that, as the opportunity offered, he availed himself of it, would you be satisfied with that? I do not and cannot believe it. In the same way, your intention does not excuse you when you have actually injured your neighbor's honor by your talk. There are others who have slandered their neighbor with a really bad intention, and they allege a still more frivolous excuse that shows them to be very ignorant. And others, they say, have spoken badly of me, and no one can blame me if I pay them back in their own coin. What nonsense! He who has taken away your good name has certainly done very wrong. And if what he has said was not before publicly known, he is bound in conscience before God to make reparation. But it is not lawful for you on that account to commit a similar sin. Did you ever hear or read that it is lawful? Is that the teaching of St. Peter, who says in his first epistle, not rendering evil for evil, nor railing for railing, but contrariwise blessing? For unto this are you called, that you may inherit a blessing. For he that will love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil, and his lips that they speak no guile. Yes, you think, but there are a few who observe that. I know there are, and so much the worse. There are precepts enough of that kind in the Christian law and in the gospel of Jesus Christ that very few pay any attention to, and for that very reason, there are few who lead a Christian life as they ought. And the saying of our Lord is true, that many are called, but few chosen. That man, you say, has taken away your good name. But what then? Do you regain your good name by injuring his? By no means. For in addition to the loss that he has caused you, you will now be looked on as one who is so possessed by the spirit of revenge that he is unable to master it and has therefore slandered his neighbor. That is a fine name for you to gain, is it not? But supposing even that you could regain your reputation by injuring his, who has made you judge in your own cause? God has appointed superior authorities to whom you may have recourse if you want your wrongs redressed. But If you seek to redress them in a lawful manner, he will have to punish you for so doing. But I am certain of what I said. I saw it with my own eyes. I heard it from one who would not tell a lie. This is the third excuse. And they who allege it betray themselves by openly declaring that they are guilty of defaming their neighbor. You say you have seen it, or heard it from a trustworthy person, and therefore that you know it to be true. Does that give you a right to reveal your neighbor's dishonor to one who has not yet heard of it? Hear what St. Thomas says. A detractor is one who speaks not against the truth, but against his neighbor's character. It is true that he who falsely attributes a crime to his neighbor is guilty of a greater sin, called calumny. But he who makes known a private crime of his neighbor is guilty of the sin of detraction. Not only the gospel law, but the light of reason alone, which teaches us not to do to others what we do not wish them to do to us, is sufficient to show how fertile that excuse is. If your mother or sister or wife or daughter had done something disgraceful and someone of the neighborhood comes to know of it, would you be satisfied if he were to relate it to others and to spread it about the town simply because he is certain of what he says? Certainly not. And why then do you try to justify yourself by the same idle excuse? I was not the first to speak of it. It had already been made known by others. Such is the fourth excuse. And if you are not the first who has committed the sin of detraction, but the second, third, fourth, fifth, or sixth, then although you are not the spring from which the stream of defamation flows, yet you are the channel by which it is spread about. It was already known and had become public talk. Such is the fifth excuse. But very few people only imagine that. They hear a thing from two or three individuals and at once jump to the conclusion that everyone knows of it. In that way, you can easily make a thing public which was before known only to a few. Even if it were public talk, and you still act, and it can hardly ever be otherwise, against Christian charity by reminding others of your neighbor's dishonor. It is the great God himself who is really offended by the sin that the other has committed. Perhaps he has forgiven that sin already, because your neighbor has repented of it. And if so, he will never remember it for all eternity, as he himself has expressly promised by the prophet Ezekiel. But if the wicked do penance for all his sins which he hath committed, I will not remember all his iniquities that he hath done. Why should you, who have not been offended by your neighbor, try to keep alive the memory of his sins? And very often, by doing so, you sin against justice. For it may happen that the fault you speak of has been forgotten through lapse of time, or that your neighbor has, by mending his life, regained the good name he had lost by that fault. To speak of it again is therefore not only contrary to Christian charity, but also to justice, as if, for instance, I were to say in the presence of others, the grandfather of such and such a one was publicly executed as a thief in such a country, or his grandmother was burned as a witch. The sixth excuse consists in saying that they were only common low people who were defamed. Common low people? Their souls are just as precious and perhaps more beautiful than yours in the sight of God. They may be as great before him as any king or prince in the world. And do you dare to take away their good name? People of lowly condition are often more sensitive in what concerns their honor. They are not blessed with riches and worldly wealth, but they do not on that account wish to part with their good name. It would be another matter if they belonged to the lowest dregs of the populace, who have already lost their good name, or who do not care to possess one. For where no honor is, honor cannot be taken away. But since I cannot be always certain that this is the case, it is a dangerous thing to say anything bad even of these, particularly if it is hitherto unknown. There are others, again, who maintain that what they said of their neighbor was of no consequence, as it was only a slight fault of his they spoke of. Well, if so, then you have committed a small sin, and is that of no consequence? But in this matter, we must not ask whether the fault spoken of is great or small in itself, but whether we notably injure our neighbor's good name and reputation by speaking of it. By disclosing even a venial sin of another, we can inflict a grievous wound on his honor, according to his position and station. For instance, if I say of a priest who has hitherto been looked upon as very pious and perfect, that he is a liar, or a sensual, worldly man, I injure his character grievously, because he is sure to lose the esteem of others on account of what I say. On the other hand, if I said of a soldier that he fought a duel, or blasphemed, or got drunk, etc., these, although they are grievous sins, would occasion little, and sometimes no loss at all, of honor to him. And why? Because among people of his class such things are not reckoned disgraceful, and are often even made a boast of. The same is to be said of other vices, which in some countries, among people of a certain position, are no longer looked on as disgraceful. Thus, in Germany, to say of an ordinary layman that he was drunk could hardly be a grievous detraction, for who would think anything of that? Alas, that I should have to say so. There is another reason also why it is dangerous to speak of even the small faults of our neighbor, because, as experience proves, the story is carried from one to another, and something is added to it each time, until at last it grows into a serious detraction. Just as, when in winter you roll a small ball of snow from the top of a mountain, it continues to increase in size until it reaches the bottom. I told it to only one friend in strict confidence, and begged of him not to say word to anyone about it. Such is the excuse that many allege, and what a vain one it is. If what you did was lawful, your friend has the same liberty, and he can tell it in strict confidence to a third, the third can tell it to a fourth, and so it goes on. For why should they have less freedom than you? And thus, your neighbor loses his good name with many, without any sin being committed by those who took it away. The raindrops first fall on the roofs of the houses, and then into the guttering, whence they are carried into the sewer. There they unite and flow into a stream along the street. So it is with detraction. It is carried from one to another. Each one relates it in confidence. "Listen, my friend," he says, "and I will tell you something, but you must keep it to yourself. And before you have time to look around, the secret is made public. But," you add, "he to whom I have told it in confidence is a pious, prudent, sensible, and God-fearing man. There is no fear of his speaking about it." Even if that is the case, do you look on it as a small matter to deprive your neighbor of the esteem of such a man? You think it a greater honor to be held in respect by a sensible and pious man than to enjoy the esteem of 100 people of indifferent character, so that by injuring your neighbor in the eyes of one good man, you cause him more suffering and do him a greater wrong than if you maligned him to 100 people of a different stamp. But some will ask, "May I not complain to my friend and say to him, 'So-and-so has wronged me or robbed me. He will not restore what belongs to me. He has led my child astray.'" No, I answered. You may not speak in that way while the matter is still unknown. Why should your friend know of it when it is not in his power to help you? And you ask again, can I not then warn my neighbor or my good friend so that he can protect himself and his children from harm when I know privately that there is reason for him to be on his guard? For instance, I say to him, keep your eye on that servant. I've noticed that he is not always to be trusted. Do not allow your son or your daughter to go into that house. There is nothing good to be learned there, as I know well. If a person asks my advice as to whether he should engage that servant, marry that person, or lend money to a certain individual, may I not give him my opinion and say to him, if I know that such is really the case, because I have seen or heard it, that person is not suited to you, I would advise you to have nothing to do with him or her. Oh, that is a different matter altogether. The sin of detraction consists in unjustly making known the private faults of your neighbor. But in the instances mentioned, you have a just reason for speaking of them, and you do so not with the intention of defaming your neighbor, but solely through the good and upright desire of putting your neighbor on his guard. There is not the least doubt that what you do is quite lawful, but you must be careful not to say more than is necessary and to see that it is kept secret. Again, it is not lawful to speak ill of one in a general way without mentioning his name. That depends. If there is no danger of anyone being suspected, there is no detraction, otherwise it would be unlawful to speak in that way. Thus it would not be right for me to say, a religious belonging to that order, that monastery, or a member of that family has sinned in such and such a way, etc. For thereby the whole order, or monastery, or family would be disgraced, and be looked on with suspicion. And besides, people would be curious to know who the culprit is. In a word, it is always dangerous to speak of the faults of others. Therefore, let each one of us make a firm, unalterable resolution with St. Augustine that nothing which is in the least prejudicial to our neighbor's character shall ever be mentioned by us, either in few words or in many, or by signs or gestures. We must not inquire whether a certain thing is grievously or slightly injurious to another, nor whether a certain fault is private or public. It ought to suffice to know that to speak of such things is contrary to the charity we owe our neighbor, whom we are bound to love as ourselves. Therefore, O God, I will not interfere with anyone, that I may study earnestly to be in thy sight what thou wishest me to be. I shall keep my tongue in check by the thought of that strict judgment in which thou wilt ask me what I have done myself, not what others have done. Therefore, I beg of thee with thy servant David, set a watch, O Lord, before my mouth, and a door round about my lips, that I may never say anything but what is to thy honor and glory, and that, when I have to speak of others, I may only speak in their praise, for with them I hope and desire to praise and glorify thee forever. Amen.